Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Real Politik. I am your host, Firas Madad. And today we're going to be talking about the Russia-Ukraine war a little bit. We're going to update you a bit on the Iran negotiations. And then we have the resignation of Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, and what this actually means and how will the will his successor handle things. And I would suspect badly, really. Sorry about that. The risks of broadcasting live. Can you hear the music as well, or is it just me hearing it?
We're just going on break for one moment, chat. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. Welcome to this episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Madad, and it turns out that the technical fault was entirely and completely mine. I'd unplugged the earphones of my laptop, and it was my laptop making the sound, nothing to do with Samsung. Sorry about that. As I'd said earlier, we're going to be talking about the Ukraine war, we're going to be talking about the negotiations between Iran and the United States, and we're briefly going to talk about Britain's next Prime Minister, the new MP from Makerfield, Andy Burnham, who is probably going to be even more useless than Keir Starmer. Now, let's get started with the Ukraine war, and I'm going to talk about a couple of things here. First, I'm going to give you a quick battlefield update as to what's going on. Then I'm going to talk to you about how Russian strategic thinking is changing around the conflict and why it's changing, because the Russians are taking quite a hammering from the Ukrainians, and what I think they're going to do next in response to that, which is probably going to be some strikes on Europe itself. And then we'll talk about the Iran stuff, and then we'll get to Britain. Now, where are we now on the battlefield? This is a map by Suriak, who is a Spanish analyst, I believe, who produces some pretty good open source maps. The map shows fixed front lines, but this is, in fact, a bit of a misrepresentation, because there's a 30-kilometer zone on either side of the troops where you have just open skies for drones, and neither side can really concentrate forces. And so the fighting happens in pretty small groups of infantry that take a lot of time to capture positions, which leads to this being a pretty slow war of attrition, which is quite expensive for the defenders and for the attackers. The Russians have some superiority in drones locally, and they are making some advances. And it seems that the Russian plan really is to try to break this major Ukrainian defensive line, which starts here in Liman and then goes through Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, and then all the way to Konstantinivka in the bottom. And this is where the bulk of the Ukrainian defenses are concentrated. And what the Russians are trying to do is to keep the Ukrainians pinned down as they attack this line, while also nibbling at it from the north and from the south. And the view is that if they can advance through here and here to try to capture this little town of Druzhivka, or however the hell you pronounce it, and continue their advances in Liman and consolidate there, the rest of the Ukrainian line would be pretty much a kill zone for the Russians, as what they would do is to try to flood the area behind these lines with drones and to attack Ukrainian logistics as they come in. And by depleting the Ukrainian logistics, they'd break the Ukrainian military in that territory. Now, the Russians are attacking in other areas. There's the Kupiansk front, which I'm not going to bore you with. There is the Vovchansk front. There is the Sumy front, where they're drawing closer to the city itself. And the idea behind these lines is just to create some distance between them and the Ukrainians, and to put pressure on the Ukrainians and to force them to send forces elsewhere. But this is the main battle line, and the second most important one is the Zaporozhye front. where, as I've mentioned in previous episodes, the Russians are moving down the two Ukrainian defensive lines, which are oriented towards the south, but the Russians are attacking them from the east. And as they go through these lines, their objective is to get to the town of Orkhiv here. Once that hub is captured, they have an easier time trying to advance towards Zaporozhye itself. This is the idea behind the Russian advances. The problem is that this is a very long and drawn-out process. To get to the city of Zaporozhye, that can maybe take 1 or 2 years. Even that might be optimistic. To finish the battle in the Donbass and to take the whole Donetsk province, that could easily be 1 or 2 years. It can be quite a drawn-out process. The Russian hope is that as this continues, they would have depleted the Ukrainian military and then they'd be able to advance faster. But what the Ukrainians will be doing is preparing more defensive lines, focusing on cities like Pavlograd and Dnipro. And they don't have a way around Sumy, because from Sumy, there are no major urban conglomerations before the Russians get to Kiev. But throughout this war, nobody's been able to make breakneck advances. And that can only happen if the Ukrainian military actually breaks, if the Ukrainian army actually collapses, which hasn't happened. And the reason that it hasn't happened is because the Ukrainians have been able to continue to conscript soldiers to force them into the fight. The Europeans are trying to help them by threatening to send away Ukrainians that have run away from the war and force them back into the country to make them fight. And in the meantime, the Ukrainians are doing two things. They are making more and more threats against Belarus, and they are escalating their own strikes against Russia itself. Now, the threats against Belarus are quite serious. Zelensky has said that there are relay stations that are helping Russian communications, that are helping the Russians identify and strike targets within Ukraine. And what Zelensky is saying is that unless Belarus withdraws the Russian equipment or forces the Russians to leave their territory, he is going to be attacking Belarus and ordering strikes on Belarusian infrastructure, including the refining facilities that supposedly provide fuel to the Russians. This is a pretty big threat, because what Zelensky is trying to do here is to say that if the Ukrainians somehow survive this war or win this war, what they will try to do is expand the conflict into Belarus and try to create an even more powerful coalition against the Russians. And if you look at the map here, the Russians are nowhere near winning the war. Not just because they're not taking the territory, but because victory requires the Russians to take the city of Odessa. The importance of Odessa is that if you have an axis that includes Odessa, Lviv, Warsaw, and Lithuania, essentially, this becomes a natural buffer state sitting between Russia and the rest of Europe. And cutting the Russians off from the rest of Europe, limiting their ability to have any movement in the Black Sea, basically cutting off Russia from trade, especially with Europe, and making Russia irrelevant to European dynamics, plus a state of that size with that population would be a serious rival to Germany. It would definitely dominate countries like Czechia or Slovakia. It would definitely dominate the Baltic states. It just becomes a major power that is a rival empire to Russia, and that is a major threat to the Russians. In addition, such a state, because it's got a historically powerful country like Germany on its borders and then Russia on the other side, that becomes a natural ally of the United Kingdom and the United States, acting as a kind of buffer that forces Europe into line on behalf of the Anglo powers. That's the big Russian fear. And Zelensky is confirming that fear by threatening Belarus. Because if you have what, you know, the west of Ukraine, Poland and Belarus and Lithuania, well, that is a very dominant player in European affairs. that's the nightmare for the Russians. And so what Zelensky is doing is that he's inviting Russian escalation by threatening escalation against Belarus. At least this is how the Russians are going to see it. Our job here is to always look at the world through the eyes of the other side, no matter who the other side is, be it the Americans or the Iranians or the Israelis or the Russians for that matter. But for the Russians, Zelensky threatening to escalate against Belarus is a major problem. Add to it the repeated strikes that the Ukrainians have been conducting against Moscow and St. Petersburg and Russian energy in general. They've been hitting Russia in very significant depth. And so we had a strike in May against Moscow, which was a big humiliation for the Russians, obviously. They tried to send in 500 drones. The Russians say they shot down most of them. Everybody exaggerates their interception rates, including the Russians. And so this was a major problem for Russia. And then during the St. Petersburg Economic Conference, we had a major attack by the Ukrainians in June, which targeted the main economic event in Russia. Every year they hold this St. Petersburg Economic Forum. We had emails from Jeffrey Epstein saying that he was supposed to meet Putin there, but Putin wouldn't give him the proper time, and so Epstein actually refused a meeting with Putin, or so he claims. This is a major issue for the Russians, because it means that they were humiliated in front of the investors and international partners that the Russians are looking to get in to invest in their economy. And we had another big attack in last week against Moscow, where we had this famous image of the refinery in Russia being blown up to kingdom come. There is some reporting that it was because of a Russian anti-aircraft missile that hit it. It wasn't actually the Ukrainians. Somehow that makes it worse. Like, if while trying to defend against the Ukrainian attack, you blew up this refinery in this spectacular way, that's not the defense that you think it is, shall we say? So this is a real and major problem for the Russians, that they are having to suffer these attacks, and that the attacks are going into the major Russian symbolic population, political, economic centers that create an image of Russia being unsafe. And it's no use for the Russians to debate the exact amount of damage and to say, you know, haha, we weren't that badly hurt. We can continue to export oil, export gas, do whatever we need to do. That still leaves Vladimir Putin looking incredibly weak. And when you have people like Medvedev, the former prime minister and president of Russia, basically calling for a much more hardline approach towards Europe and towards the West, that really becomes quite an embarrassment for Putin and weakens his position internally quite significantly. I'm not saying there's going to be a coup against him or anything like that, but Putin governs through some kind of general consensus. All of these authoritarian regimes, you rarely get an actual Stalin who is completely in charge of every decision. You almost never get that. In all of these authoritarian regimes, there are various regime intellectuals, there are regime propagandists, there are hardliners, there are doves, and there is an ongoing debate, and the guy at the top has to adjudicate between the different sides. That's what you see in Iran. It's what you used to see in China. Xi is considerably stronger than previous Chinese leaders. That's what you see in Russia. And so these kinds of attacks are humiliating Putin. And the fact that the war doesn't look like it's ending anytime soon, because although the Russians can claim progress, that progress is incredibly slow, and the price for it is getting heavier, that means that the Russians need to do something. And to understand what they need to do, this is a pretty good location to start. This is one of the main think tanks of the Russian Federation, the Center for Defense and Strategic Policies, I think, and it is the Council on Foreign and Defense Policy, and it is the convener of the Valdai Conference that happens every year in Russia, which is the main geopolitical event on the Russian calendar, which is regularly attended by Vladimir Putin personally. So, in the same way that when you want to understand American thinking, you have to listen to the Council on Foreign Relations, you have to listen to the Atlantic Council. In Britain, you have to listen to Chatham House, because these are the entities that inform the decision makers. That's the counterpart in Russia. And a big part of the Putin legacy has been to sort of try to replicate the Western systems in Russia. And so this is an institute that was founded in 1992, and it has grown in importance. And this is the honorary chairman of that institute speaking. And here what he's arguing in this piece is that, yes, the special military operation has been good. It's allowed Russia to weed out the evil influences of the West. By the way, there's something that should be said about Russian thinking, especially as reflected by this guy. What's his name again? Karaganov. They view the West as inherently evil. They view especially Northwestern Europe as inherently evil. And they bleat constantly about colonialism and racism and all that kind of stuff. And they preach instead Eurasianism, which is the fusion of Russia and China into an Asian superpower that is jointly run, that can deliver some kind of utopia. This is inherently evil thinking, because the way that they see the world starts from the West is evil. And everything that the West has done throughout its history has been evil. And these guys, you want to understand them as the people who still hold a grudge over the role of the Latins in the loss of Constantinople in the last crusade, which attacked Constantinople, and in the fourth crusade, which attacked Constantinople. And they are still not over that issue. So this is their worldview, and it's important to remember that. And they define the West intrinsically as enemies, and they are more emphatic about the legacy of the Second World War than most others, which is understandable, because the losses for the Russians of the Second World War were 20 million people. Now, in exchange, they ended up dominating all of Eastern Europe, but their losses were quite catastrophic. So that's the mindset that you're dealing with here. And what is being said here is that this guy warned the Europeans that the expansion of NATO into Ukraine was going to lead to a major war. The Europeans ignored this, and they kept on escalating in Ukraine, which is actually true. He's right about that. And that this is part of the European DNA, for lack of a better phrase, because, you know, the hatred of Russia was cultivated by the Austro-Hungarians, the Poles, and other Western countries who set the Ukrainians against Russia. And so what is needed is isolation from the Ukrainian and European maladies to follow our own path of healthy and sound development. And then he goes on to say that the Russians are actually winning the war, but the Russians aren't properly responding to escalation by Europe. And here's the key thing. And that the Russians haven't actually destroyed the coalitions that have emerged against them. And that Europe is preparing for new escalation. And they are backing Nazis in Ukraine, which is another a partial truth, shall we say. And so the only way to stop the Europeans is by threatening them with nuclear weapons. And what he's advocating here is that major targets in Europe, including control centers, critical infrastructure, and military bases, of those European countries that play a key role in preparing and executing military operations against Russia must be hit. And they should include targets where the elites live and work. Let their capitals finally sober up. If conventional strikes have no effect, and Europe does not capitulate or at least retreat, we should be fully prepared militarily and, most importantly, politically and psychologically to launch limited but sufficient for political effect retaliatory strikes with strategic nuclear weapons. That's what's being advocated here. And then if you look at another piece here from the same think tank, the argument is about Iran and how Iran succeeded because it didn't just strike American military targets in the region, but also the assets of key American partners. And then stuff about the weapon stockpile and the tolerance for damage and so on and so forth. So in the minds of the Russians, the Iranian strategy of attacking the US's allies worked. And the Europeans are so evil and unhinged that they need the same treatment, including the threat of launching nuclear weapons against them, in order to achieve a similar effect. And again, this is what they are thinking according to the most important think tank in Russia. And if you want to understand what the Russians are thinking, that's a pretty important starting point. So, if you're Russia, where does this logic lead you? Well, it probably ends up leading you towards actually striking Europe. And specifically, it leads you towards attacking the energy infrastructure in Europe, especially the LNG facilities and the storage facilities in the EU and probably in Britain. With the idea being that if you fire initially drones and then something like an Oreshnik hypersonic missile, which can't be intercepted, against energy targets or against military industries or against airports or similarly important assets, you would show the Europeans that they are going to be paying a price for continuing to support Ukraine. If you sort of reconcile between the fact that Putin has to adjudicate between different factions within the ruling elite in Russia, and that he himself is closer to the dovish side. Putin is cast as a cartoon villain in Western media. But in reality, on the Russian spectrum, he's closer to the liberal dovish side than he is to the hardline militarist side, which you're hearing from here in this think tank that we were discussing. And so the approach, if you reconcile these two realities, is probably going to be Russia saying to Europe, look, as of next week, if you keep on backing Ukraine, we are going to start hitting targets within Europe. And then they can bet on the fact that the Americans didn't want a major war against Iran. There is no reason to believe that they would want a major war against Russia. And that even though there is this influence in the United States that keeps on pushing for escalation, the political decision makers backed down against Iran, they would probably end up backing down against Russia. And without escalating the crisis dramatically, there is no way for the crisis to be resolved other than continuing to fight this war of attrition against the Ukrainians, possibly indefinitely, for another 2 or 3 years, 5 years. Maybe 10 years, who knows? And so it's kind of logical to think, if you're looking at the world from the Russian perspective, that the next step that the Russia is going to take is to issue some kind of ultimatum to the Europeans. That if you release more funding to Ukraine, we are going to hit targets within European countries. If you enjoyed this preview, please consider subscribing to lotuseaters.com starting for just £5 a month.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.